You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN 91.9 FM. I'm Skylar Butenchen. The Seaside City Council has filled the empty Ward 4 seat after a tumultuous 2 weeks of community discussion, online and offline, about one of the candidates. KMUN's Katie Frankowitz has the story.
The Ward 4 seat has been empty since the end of December after former city councilor Dave Puzalski moved away from the area. As his replacement, he championed regional hotel manager Brandon Kraft. But at a meeting earlier this month where the Seaside City Council was expected to choose between Kraft and a second candidate, construction project manager Patrick Ansborough, Kraft instead faced accusations of homophobia and bigotry and questions about whether he was on a government watch list. The allegations stemmed from past Facebook posts attributed to Kraft by community members and from an interview Kraft gave with a Seaside writer. Kraft has denied the allegations and pushed back at city councilors Seamus McVeigh and Heidi Hoffman, who voiced their concerns at a city council meeting and, in Hoffman's case, on Facebook, too. The council ended up split between Kraft and Ansborough. At a meeting Monday, Mayor Steve Wright, seeing the vote would fall along similar lines again, switched his support from Kraft to Ansborough. But there was one thing Wright wanted to make clear.
But absolutely, it is not a vote against Brandon Kraft. Understand that.
Wright emphasized that the Ward 4 appointment is temporary. Ansborough will hold the seat through the end of 2026, but given the community engagement already, Wright predicts there could be a, quote, good election run for the seat this fall. Kraft says he is considering running for election. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN.
Oregon started processing 2025 tax returns on Monday. About 15% of Oregonians don't file every year because they're worried about a big tax bill or intimidated by the long, complicated tax forms. But as Christian Fodenvenzel reports, those people often miss out on significant refunds, and there are several nonprofits anxious to help everyone file.
33-year-old Hilario Gonzalez immigrated from Colombia a couple of years ago. While waiting for asylum, he's going to school and cleaning hotel rooms in Portland. But that means income and a tax return. Complicated propositions, even for someone who speaks English proficiently. So Gonzalez sought help from Multnomah Family Services Cash Oregon, a nonprofit that helps people file taxes.
The plan is to be able to comply with all the rules and regulations regarding tax payments and make sure that I'm doing it the right way.
And quite apart from doing things the right way, Gonzalez got a refund.
$1,700, and that included federal and state.
That's a good refund.
It was really, really good for me.
His employer had deducted too much, and Gonzalez qualified for something called the Earned Income Tax Credit. The director of Cash Oregon, Riley Eldridge, says Oregon ranks close to last in people claiming that credit.
They're scared of the process. They're intimidated by it. They might not understand X, Y, or Z thing that's going on with it because it's a subject that's not very well understood.
Cash Oregon has trained 360 volunteers for this tax season, and it's just one of a dozen such Volunteer Income Tax Assistance, or VITA, programs in Oregon.
We helped almost 10,000 families file last year. They got about $14 million in refunds. And these are households that make, on average, $28,000 a year. This is rent payments, this is transportation, this is food on the table.
Often, he says, Cash Oregon doesn't just reduce people's tax burden, they actually find them a refund check. Take a married couple with two kids making $20,000 a year.
With the Earned Income Tax Credit alone, you know, this could be up to, you know, $6,000. And we're not even talking about the child tax credit and other credits that could be behind that.
Once families understand this, they start asking for help, and that's the problem. While there are hundreds of VITA programs across the country, appointments get booked up quickly. On top of that, the Trump administration ended a free e-filing program last year, and some VITA programs have seen deep cuts. Cash Oregon lost 30% of its staff last year because of state cuts. As a result, VITA programs are desperately looking for volunteers to help people file taxes.
If you like puzzles, you're very likely going to like tax preparation.
Volunteers at Cash Oregon include CPAs who want to help, accounting students getting experience, and people who've received help from VITA programs in the past. That's Pradeep Gunathan's story. He's a research scientist for Intel now, but came to the U.S. 14 years ago. As a student, he secured a couple of internships, which meant he had taxable income.
And I was kind of thrown into the deep end, like not knowing anything about the tax code in this country.
A woman from his university helped him file, and he never forgot her kindness.
I thanked her, but I also wanted to pay it forward. So I decided that I would at some point get into helping people with their taxes, just like she did.
With his expertise in non-resident taxes, Gurunathan is now an invaluable volunteer at Cash Oregon. And VITA programs across Oregon are looking for volunteers just like him. But it's not easy. Training takes about 40 hours. There's an exam and a background check. After all, nobody wants an identity thief rooting through their financial information. But Gurunathan says the reward is the work itself. He remembers an autistic woman who wore sunglasses and headphones to reduce the office clatter. He brought her to a quiet corner, and after helping her file, she handed him a note.
It's Pradeep. Each of us bears the imprint of a friend met along the way. In each, the trace of each, for good or evil, in wisdom or in folly. Everyone stamped by everyone. Thank you.
He's grinning from ear to ear. Tax returns in Oregon are expected to be up this year because if you don't file, you don't get the kicker.
I'm Christian Foden-Wenzel reporting.
Washingtonians across the state are looking to curb youth access to kratom, a federally unregulated substance that can get users high. But the state and individual cities are taking different approaches. Eliza Billingham reports.
The Washington State Senate is considering a bill that would put a 95% tax on kratom products and require kratom retailers to have a license. All tax revenue would fund harmful substance prevention efforts for youth. Amy Brackenberry, on behalf of the Washington State Public Health Association, says her organization would like regulation to go further.
We believe regulation needs a broader set of guardrails, including the age gating of the product for ages 21 and up.
Oregon currently has a similar age restriction on kratom purchasers and requires kratom retailers to register every year. The city of Spokane is currently considering an outright ban against kratom. The ordinance is scheduled to have its first reading this week. If it passes next week, Spokane would be the first Washington city to ban the product outright. A lobbyist for the American Kratom Association told senators that his organization supports age restrictions and labeling requirements, but it would only seek to ban 7-OH, a synthetic substance that's sometimes found in kratom products that has opioid-like effects. I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
The waters may have receded from last month's widespread flooding in Washington, but the hard work of recovery is just beginning. Local farmers are cleaning up and replacing things that were swept off in the waters, starting with soil. KUOW's Ruby DeLuna reports.
It's fallow season at Ryan Lichtenniger's farm in Fall City. Come spring, he hopes the fields will be full again with greens and grains, but today they're mostly bare. In the farm staging area, the only area that didn't flood, there are remnants from the catastrophic event. A green school bus, a white trailer, and some farm equipment, items that neighboring farmers brought over to keep safe. Lichtenniger takes me to one side of the farm where they had dug out the radicchio, carrots, and celery before the field filled with water.
You can see what it's done. It's loosened up the soil so much, even though there's crop residue on top, that the water came in over the road here and got a little bit of speed and just washed out the entire top layer of soil.
He traces the length of the row where the water likely flowed. At the end of the row is a heap of dirt.
Some of it went and piled up, so we had to grab the tractor and scoop up a couple buckets and we'll put it here.
He's also trying to salvage what's left of the garlic plants, covering them with fresh compost and a blanket of straw. For farmers like Lichtenniger, the loss is more than just dirt.
I've been farming in this spot for almost 12 years. And I've spent those whole 12 years adding minerals, adding fertilizers, micronutrients, macronutrients, biologicals, to try to boost the effectiveness of the soil. And when that just can wash away in a matter of hours, it's devastating.
This is the flood's hidden damage. Healthy soil is crucial and determines how crops will do. David Montgomery is professor at the University of Washington. He focuses on earth surfaces, including dirt.
And think of healthy, fertile soils as the foundation that keeps civilization afloat. And yet we take it for granted and treat it like dirt.
He says floods can be beneficial. The water provides a fresh injection of minerals that helps to restore soil health. But that also depends on the size of the flood.
The bigger the floods you get, the more violent they tend to be, just because you got more water flowing faster. And that gives them more power, more energy to do damage to the landscape.
And often, the water also carries undesirable stuff in its path.
You don't want the plastics. You don't want the oil. You don't want runoff from roads.
Montgomery says the kind of flooding that's ideal would be like filling and draining a bathtub, slowly.
One of the worries in terms of the direction the climate seems to be going in this region is that we're getting more variable weather and we're getting bigger floods more often. That's not a good thing.
Last month's flooding was considered historic. Nearly 89,000 acres of crop fields in 13 counties were affected, according to initial estimates by the state's Department of Agriculture. The agency says the full impact won't be known until well after this year's crop season. Back in Fall City, Ryan Lichtenniger has started restoring the soil in his farm. He points to a mound of compost in the staging area.
You know, we're on it. We got a text chain with like 10 farmers. And we're like, where are you getting compost this year?
They're picky about the compost, which can carry invasive weed seeds, plastics, and diseases. But this batch from Snohomish has good telltale signs.
These are cup fungi growing out of it, just out of the top. That's mycelium, and that's really beneficial for the soil and the plants. Worms have found their way in.
These organisms and healthy bacteria are like probiotics for the soil. He'll also plant cover crops and add organic materials. But the best part during this quiet season is picking out seeds and crop planting.
It gets you excited and your blood pumping, thinking about the new growth and what's possible.
Farming may be a big gamble, but Lichtenniger says farmers are always optimistic. In Fall City, I'm Ruby DeLuna reporting.
As President Trump has unveiled his plans to remake the military, he's calling for the Navy to do something it hasn't done since World War II, build new battleships. The last of the massive vessels was retired decades ago in favor of smaller, more versatile ships, and experts are skeptical of the plan to build new ones. Steve Walsh reports for the American Homefront Project.
One of America's last battleships, USS Wisconsin, is moored on the Elizabeth River in Norfolk. A floating museum, its most recent battle was winning the Great Christmas Light Fight this past holiday season.
This is the main bridge of the pilot house. This structure right here is something very unique to a World War II battleship.
David Woods is one of the tour guides. A retired warrant officer, Woods spent 30 years in naval aviation, often working on aircraft carriers.
A little stipulation we have with the Navy, there are certain things we can't do to the ship as a museum because they have to be able to take the ship back and undo everything we did within like 2 or 3 weeks.
USS Wisconsin came into service in 1944. It was revived briefly during the Reagan defense buildup in the 1980s, then decommissioned again in the early 1990s after its 16-inch guns were used for shore bombardment in the first Gulf War. Its nearly 13-inch steel hull is thick enough to withstand a modern Tomahawk cruise missile, but running it would cost nearly $1 million a day in just fuel. The ship would require a complete retrofit, and it's probably no longer the ship the Navy needs, Wood says.
Trust me, I wish we could have these things operational. I would volunteer to come out of a retirement in a heartbeat to serve on one of them. But in modern warfare, feasibility-wise, they're just obsolete, unfortunately.
Woods is skeptical of the Trump administration's plan to revive battleships and build 20 to 25 new ones.
Just the size, the complexity. Today's ships have to be multifunction. Good way to describe like the difference between a battleship and a destroyer. A battleship is a Bowie knife. A destroyer is a Swiss Army knife. You know, it can do anti-surface, anti-air, anti-submarine.
The Navy had been planning for a new, more powerful destroyer before President Trump made battleships the center of what he's calling the Golden Fleet. The destroyer is now on hold as Chief of Naval Operations Admiral Darrell Cottle embraced battleships in a speech in January.
The battleship will anchor maritime fires and sea control in the most contested environments, massing durable combat power and observing punishment an adversary cannot match.
The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the first ship could cost as much as $22 billion. Follow-ups could still be between $10 to $15 billion. The design concept of the new ship that was unveiled at the president's press conference at Mar-a-Lago has been pulled from the internet, but the battleship was more than double the length of the current destroyers and needed almost three times the crew. Brian Clark with the Hudson Institute says it's one thing to say the Navy needs a larger ship, which could launch more missiles.
It's another thing to say I need to have a laser on it, and I need to have a railgun on it, and other systems that don't exist yet and that are going to be too complex to introduce all into one platform without creating a massive increase in cost and schedule.
The Navy dropped plans for railguns, which fire metal bolts rather than shells, in 2021 when the program failed to produce a working model. The Navy has a history of stopping production after a couple of ships when delays pile up and costs get out of hand. They did that with the Zumwalt class of destroyer. The Trump administration just ended the Constellation class frigate. A new battleship could be the costliest U-turn in Navy history.
And they end up abandoning it. Now you've got these orphan ships that have a lot of unique capabilities that will be difficult to maintain in that small scale.
Clark says Congress will still have a say in whether the ship is built. Even if they approve the plan, the U.S. won't roll out its first battleship since 1944 for at least a decade. In Norfolk, I'm Steve Walsh.
You're listening to KMUN. Up next is the American Democracy Minute. Stay tuned after that for the Ship Report with Joanne Rideout.
You're listening to the American Democracy Minute, keeping your government by and for the people. As you'll recall, the Utah State Court struck down multiple GOP efforts to neutralize a constitutional amendment creating an independent redistricting commission and a ban on gerrymandering. Despite wide bipartisan support for the Fair Redistricting Amendment, a new Trump-endorsed ballot measure aims to repeal it. The Proposition 4 constitutional amendment was passed in 2018 by a narrow margin, with 50.34% of the vote. The state legislature has been out to undo it ever since. But a new poll by Better Boundaries Utah now shows 57% of voters disapprove of the legislature's efforts to neutralize the independent commission, 65% that Utah voters should have the power to establish election district boundaries and should have the final say over those boundaries, and 71% believe there should be neutral independent standards for redistricting. Another citizen ballot measure hoping to repeal the independent commission is currently collecting signatures, but is still short of qualifying for the November ballot, with only 3 weeks left. President Donald Trump posted on social media January 23rd, urging his base to sign the petition. The GOP-dominated legislature isn't waiting for the ballot initiative outcome and is appealing its partisan redistricting legislation to the Utah Supreme Court. We've linked to a timeline on Utah's battle for fair redistricting at AmericanDemocracyMinute.org. I'm Brian Beal.
You're listening to KMUN News. If you have a news tip or story idea, get in touch. Email us at news1@kmun.org. That's news, the numeral 1, at kmun.org. Local and regional news on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and the KMUN News team. That includes me, host and producer Skylar Butenchin, news intern Sylvia Thorpe, and news director Katie Frankowitz. Our news broadcasts air Monday through Thursday, beginning at 7:59 in the morning and 4:59 in the evening.